The purpose of this congregation is to enable each of us to work for justice, love, and tolerance and dignity in our lives, in our families, in the world. Another way to say this is that our purpose is to help people wake up. Wake up to love, wake up to justice, wake up to dignity and tolerance. To wake up, to wake people up is why we gather each Sunday. It's why we serve coffee each Sunday. Now, you've had those mornings where it's hard to wake up. Some mornings where you didn't sleep quite well and everything seems to be in a cloud, a mental fog. Moments where things are difficult. Moments where your mind seems sluggish or your spirit is resistant to respond to the beauty of the world or to its harshness even. You may make foolish mistakes. You might try to read a paragraph of some news over and over and never get what it says. You may put things in the wrong place. So we want to be awake. We resist that feeling of not being quite awake, being half asleep, being inattentive to the world. It's both a literal experience, but also a metaphor for a way of moving, a way of thinking, a way of being. You all should remember the story from the Dona Sutra of the Buddha. Gautama Buddha is walking along, and a man comes up to him and says, "Are you a god?" And Gautama Buddha says, "No." He says, "Are you a deva? Are you a spirit being? Are you a sorcerer?" Going through each of these lists, and each time Buddha says, "No." And finally, he says, "Are you just a holy man?" And Buddha says, "No." And then Gautama says, "Remember me as awakened." So I hope that each of you will in some way or another be awakened, called back to awareness. The word Buddha appeared in English around 1680. It was a translation of the past participle of a Pali word, bud, which means to awake. It also means to come to know or to perceive something. So the word Buddha means literally an awakened understanding or seeing person, enlightened. I remind you of those words, perhaps some of you have read from William Wordsworth, poet, Unitarian-influenced poet. Wordsworth said, "While with an eye made quiet by the power of harmony and the deep power of joy, we see into the life of things." What does it mean to be awake? It does not simply mean to be able to see things with some clarity. It means to be able to see into the very heart of things, into the very life of things. I tell stories about coyote. Coyote reminds us of human intelligence and creativity. So really, I'm talking about our own intelligence and the ways in which we deceive ourselves, the ways in which we deceive others, the ways in which we play tricks with ideas. And really, all animals share some little bit or pieces of our same awareness and awakening. Human beings, I find, in no way are completely different than any other living thing. Everything in us is shared with other living things, and we are part of, woven together, but we uniquely, or at least to a level that is unique, have creativity and intelligence and thoughtfulness, and we need to work with those constantly. Realizing that our own minds will trick ourselves, trick one another. We're always falling asleep and not noticing what others are doing, making assumptions about the world. So I wonder, does coyote ever wake up? Did Jesus wake up? Was he an awakened person? And are you awake today? To be awake is not simply to be able to notice things, but it's to notice the very heart. You see into the life of things. Much of what Unitarian Universalism is grounded in what we call the Age of Enlightenment. The this great moment in human history where reason and scientific discipline transformed everything. Our roots, of course, as a religious movement, go back thousands of years before that, go back to the ethics and the moral principles of the Jewish prophets and feed straight through the life of Jesus and those who are deeply inspired by Jesus, but draws upon other sources of inspiration from Buddha and other places. But most centrally, we are inspired by the scientific revolution and the way in which that epistemology, that way of understanding what we can know and how we can know, transformed everything. It got us to question the ways in which authority lived in human societies. It changed the way in which we treated one another. Ideas of equality and justice for all started to develop and bubble and rise up in ways that had never been evolved before. It led to revolutions, both figurative and literal, of the mind and in politics. And science was not simply about facts. A person we often call the father of empiricism, Francis Bacon, back in 1620, in his Novum Organum, in his one of his aphorisms, said, "No one has yet been found. No one has been found so firm of mind and purpose as resolutely to compel himself to sweep away all theories and common notions and to apply the understanding, thus made fair and even to a fresh examination of the particulars." No one has really, he said, we can see the particulars of life, but we do not see into the life of things. And he says, "Thus it happens that human knowledge as we have it is a mere medley, an ill-digested mass made up of much credulity, much accident, and also all of the childish notions which we first imbibed." He was aware very much how human beings move through the world basically asleep. The things that we know, the things that we think we know, the ways in which we interpret and understand the world are often wrong. We've been engaging in this and dealing with racism or sexism or heterosexism, fighting against the ways in which our minds run on assumptions and guesses about what is real and what is true. The facts are not enough. I'm very aware of the tragedy of life. I can see the facts. I've known children who have died. I am aware that I will get sick, I will grow old, I will die, everything that I know and love will change, and I own nothing. I own nothing permanently except my own actions in the moment. I've been very aware of my emotions these last weeks. One of the things I've been thinking about is how we want things to be permanent. We want things to endure. And each religion has come up with some way of talking about what is permanent, what is enduring, what is really at the base of all the facts, what drives reality itself. And I was thinking about secular humanism. We draw, of course, on Jewish and Christian scriptures. We draw on the traditions also, to a lesser extent, of Buddhism and Hinduism and Islam. And we draw on Native American and neo-pagan traditions, and each one has a different way of talking about what's permanent and eternal. And I thought about humanism and science, this whole revolution of scientific humanism and naturalistic humanism and non-religious humanism. And I thought, what is permanent? What is it that they speak about? What is it that that way of thinking holds up as permanent and enduring? And of course, many people present humanism as the only things that are permanent, the only things that are enduring are things like the force of gravity, or some sort of microscopic forces within subatomic particles, maybe the laws of thermodynamics. And that leaves us with a very cold world, a difficult world. I mean, literally cold, because the average temperature of the universe is very low, but also emotionally cold. And then it struck me that in humanism and secular humanism, what motivates that whole way of philosophy is the quality of human life and a care for human beings. It's love. That love is permanent. That it arises in our hearts and we see it between birds and even insects drawn to one another in companionship, hearing each other's echoes. Even in science, in clear and rational thought, it is not merely the facts, not merely the particulars, but to see into the heart of things that matters most. I've been very aware also of the facts of my emotions. I mentioned that. I've been feeling many more emotions. Anger comes up for me more lately. And fears come up more often. And all of this is because my life is in turmoil. I am essentially, you know, I have a home. I have an apartment that I can rent. But it's, I don't know where I will be living permanently. I don't have any permanent certain residence, and everything is in transition, and it's making me more irritated. I'm aware of that. I'm aware of those facts. But what do I do with those emotions? And most of us just simply feel our emotions, most human beings at least, just feel our emotions. We're not too conscious of them. There's this wonderful story, an announcement of the release of something called the Atlas of Emotions that came out this last week. So there's a man named Paul Ekman and his daughter, Eve Ekman. Paul's a psychologist and Eve is working in doctoral experimentation on integrative health processes. And they worked with the Dalai Lama and some web designers to create this thing called the Atlas of Emotions. And as they were developing this thing, they were also contacted by Pixar, the movie studio, and consulted with them on the movie Inside Out, which was about emotions, noticing emotions, paying attention to emotions. But it's not simply being aware of the fact that we have emotions and mind and memory and trying to think about it. The Atlas itself is really interesting. They have these five global continents of emotions, and then within each there's various states of intensity. The Atlas describes actions and triggers that trigger those emotions, and then actions that can arise out of the emotions. All of this is about becoming more aware of the nature of emotions, how they drive within us, the roles that they play. And the hope, of course, is that people will use this information to become more wise, to move more easily through the world, and ultimately to make the world more peaceful, more just, more loving, more tolerant, more dignified. Right? It's an interesting tool. But in the movie, the little movie, Inside Out, one of the key points was not simply to be aware of sadness and enjoyment, which are two of the global emotions, global continents of emotion that they have, but the way in which sadness and enjoyment interact with each other, depend upon each other. There's an interreaction. The ways in which fear and disgust interact with each other, sometimes to make us cruel. And in the Atlas of Emotion, they allow people to, there's little moments where you can see judgments on the emotions and the actions based on their ability to either enhance or undermine your cooperation with other people. Because ultimately there's a desire not simply to see the facts of emotions and to understand emotions. There's all sorts of interesting things I could say about the Atlas of Emotion, but the point is that they're trying to lead people towards a deeper sense of not only understanding of oneself, but also of other people, to build greater compassion in the world, to move us all towards wholeness, towards peace. To see the ways in which we trick ourselves, the ways in which we deceive ourselves. When I was coming back to St. Louis, I had this moment where I did not know where my wallet was. And I was absolutely certain that I had dropped it somewhere. And I felt this moment of extreme panic. Like, what are the thieves doing with my credit cards right now? What are the thieves going to do with my driver's license? There was this horrible fear that I felt. As I was thinking through and I was looking through my bags, I just kept saying, I couldn't imagine where I dropped it or when I dropped it. I couldn't figure out where that moment was. All of a sudden, I remembered that I'd had it in my coat and that I'd wrapped my coat up and stuck it in the suitcase. And so finally, you know, I kept looking at the coat and not really thinking, oh, there's my wallet. I would just think, there's my coat. I finally took it out. There was my wallet wrapped inside of it. And all that fear, all that intense fear that I had been feeling just dissolved away immediately. And I thought of how often people live with fear and anger, and they believe in that fear and anger, and they're motivated by it in their actions. And it's usually built on some misperception, or often built on a misperception of the world. How often? Think of the whole war against Iraq, which was really a set of assumptions and certain facts taken to an extreme end, an immoral war, the death of thousands, unnecessary death of thousands, and the continued death and instability of that country, built on fear, built on anger, built on disgust, built on our emotions and the ways in which we allow them to trick ourselves without seeing into the heart of things and the need to work for peace. To wake up, to become alive, to see the world as it is. The Unitarian poet Henry David Thoreau, writer and poet, had a poem called Insight, in which he said, "But now there comes unsought, unseen, some clear divine electuary," which is a sort of medicine within sweetness, so it's a sweet medicine. "And I, who had but sensual been, grow sensible, and as God is, am wary. I hearing get, who had only ears, and sight, who had but eyes before. I moments live, who had lived only years, and truth discern, who knew but learning's yore." This, of course, is inspired by a line from Jesus in the Gospel of John, where he speaks about coming into the world so the blind will see, or in Luke, where he speaks about the blind seeing. And Paul, writing in his letter to the Corinth, says, "We focus on what is unseen, since what is seen is temporary, what is unseen is eternal." And Wordsworth speaking of that moment where he could see into the life of things. But what's striking about Wordsworth's poem is that in the end of that poem, though he talks about this transcendent moment in the middle, turns about this moment in which he can see through nature. He's in nature, of course, the natural world, and we all talk about how the being in the natural world is often a source of grounding and inspiration. In the end of the poem, he comes back to the fact that the reason it was so truly joyful was he was there with his beloved sister, his sister and friend. He was there with someone else. The problem with being deluded by emotions or by thoughts is that you don't usually know that you are deluded unless someone else points it out to you. And so it is that we gather in community, not only to remind ourselves of our short-sightedness and our foolishness, like Coyote, but also to help one another see into the life of things, to see into the heart of things, to see the power of love and goodness that rolls through this congregation, through the city, and out to the end of all things. May we be awake to that. May we wake up to that. And in it, live amidst the sorrow and the suffering of life, turning it slowly into calm, clear enlightenment.